Welcome to Pieces of Choice, the podcast where we explore how conscious awareness can help us cultivate inner peace and transform our lives. I'm Natasha Wallace, and in each episode, we'll hear from guests about their personal journeys, the challenges they faced, and how they found peace, and also how they're helping to cultivate more peace in the world. Today, I'm lucky enough to be joined by Steve Hargreaves. Steve is an award-winning leadership and culture crafter, coach and mentor, facilitator, and author of The Compassionate Leader's Playbook. Welcome to the podcast, Steve.
Well, thank you, Natasha. Thanks for having me. What a lovely welcome.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be spending time with you, Steve. Shall we jump straight in? I'd love you to tell the audience about your journey and what led you to focus on compassionate leadership, as that is your subject of choice.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I spent about 20 years in management and leadership positions. I qualified as a social worker many, many years ago, Natasha, and I qualified in the South Wales area, and I worked in the South Wales Valley communities working across childcare and older adult services. And then I found myself in management roles, and a couple of things struck me early on. One big driver for me was one of the team managers in the social work team took their own life very early on, and that had quite a profound impact on me and I suppose my understanding about work, about mental health, about how people suffer and how you might not be aware, you might not know. Mm. And whilst that's a longer story, that was part of the driver, I suppose, to move into management. And I spent many years working in adult social care, running operations departments and running residential homes for older people, and moved into the charity sector. So I suppose the reason to share that is my journey has been quite vocational. It started in adult social care and then I moved into the charity sector. And I found myself then as a head of service and then as a director. And what I found was, as a director, I was involved a great deal with disciplinaries and grievances. So three things have been my drivers for compassion. One, doing lots of investigations around disciplines and grievances and getting to a point where, and I don't know if you've been here, Natasha, where person A and person B might describe their relationship as, I hate the other person. The other person's destroyed my life. They've destroyed my work. They won't be in the same room with each other. So we're at this point where we've reached this top of the pyramid in terms of the challenge that they both have. And I used to think, well, how on earth have we got into a position where these two individuals over a period of time or a period of years have not been able to resolve this? How have we got to a position where the organisation has not created the conditions for these to be resolved earlier on? Where has that lack of empathy come from? These two people no longer seeing each other as human beings. You know, now see each other as enemies that need to be confronted and beaten. How has that occurred? Secondly, I had the role of Freedom to Speak Up guardian for a national charity, which was a real privilege. So that was about supporting people to speaking up on their behalf sometimes, and speaking truth to power, particularly where systems, processes or conditions were a hindrance to people speaking up. And there was one particular example where somebody had the courage to speak up to a director, and it had followed an example I'd had with another speaking up case where the senior manager had become very defensive, very protective, very adversarial, and punished this individual for speaking up. And I saw the damage that had on that person and also on the leader, the legacy that that had. And then I also supported this person to speak up to a senior leader, and the compassion and empathy and understanding that leader showed to that individual was so powerful, so compelling, and had such a different outcome. So compassion played a part. And then lastly is, one of my children was diagnosed with a very serious health condition, and suddenly we were thrust into the first time with one of our children being in and out of hospital, outpatients, inpatients, allied health professionals. It was a really scary, scary time. And what I noticed very, very quickly was we never had any issue with the clinical care. But my child's recovery and resilience was hugely driven by how compassionate people had been to them. Mm. So did that consultant, nurse or doctor know their name? Did they address them with their questions? Did they listen? were they included in conversations about their care and treatment? So collectively, all of those things drove me to what is this thing called compassion? Because it's so important when it shows up and it can have such a negative impact when it doesn't. That was a long intro, but it's been an interesting journey and that drove me to the work that I do now.
Yes, well, thank you so much. That was really interesting. I don't think we've ever had that conversation, which seems absolutely bonkers because we've known each other for years. We've worked together loads. We've travelled around the world working together. But I don't think I've ever asked you that question. That I feel actually bad about that.
Well, isn't that interesting, though? But that's, we've got so many interesting things to talk about. But I think that's what drove me, because I was very happy in my role as a director, but it drove me, I suppose, like so many people, how can I spend more time at work doing more of what I really care about? And what I realised was I had begun to really care about this area of compassion, but particularly how to operationalise it, how to make it practical and operational at work. So it wasn't something that was seen as something academic or soft and fluffy. It was like a really powerful organisational lever and driver. How can I help organisations, leaders and their teams make that practical? Because it's powerful when it's there.
Absolutely. No, I really see that. And it comes up in a lot of my conscious leadership work. And I mean, we've joked about this many a time that I've got the conscious leadership company and you've got the compassionate leadership company. And I think I might have set my business up after yours.
Well, I mean,
so I copied you.
I didn't want to say. But I think they get along beautifully.
They do. I mean, they're absolutely brilliant partners. But actually, let's go back because... I mean, I can't even remember when we met, but I'm going to say it was probably about 6 or 7 years ago.
Yep, absolutely.
And I saw you posted something on LinkedIn and I just thought, this is a guy I think I could relate to. So I think I dropped you a LinkedIn message just to say it'd be really great to connect. I mean, it wasn't your beard, but, you know, for the people who can't see Steve right now, he does have a rather beautiful beard. It probably was a little bit about your beard, if I'm honest.
Well, you know, whatever it drew you to me, if it's facial hair, then that's a win. I'll take it.
Yeah, well, and actually you were the head of learning and development for St John Ambulance at the time, weren't you? I can remember coming down to Bristol to see you, where we talked about conscious leadership. And I mean, our relationship sort of blossomed from there on in. I never did serve you as a client, but of course we have done lots of work together since, because there's such a significant part of conscious leadership that is about empathy and compassion and seeing the other person and understanding them. And we've spoken about your speak up role. What was it called again? What did you refer to it as?
Freedom to Speak Up Guardian, which is a role that originated in the NHS. So Freedom to Speak Up Guardian is very much about positioning speaking up as a core characteristic of a healthy functional organisation and a healthy functional team. We took that and rolled it out within St John Ambulance. Obviously, the intention here is for other people to feel that the risk to themselves of speaking up is sufficiently low that they will take that risk, because it requires huge courage, doesn't it? And this is where I think compassion comes in, because compassion requires so much courage, because you're vulnerable, aren't you? You know, when you speak up, when you disagree, when you share a different idea, a different perspective, you're doing a dynamic risk assessment, aren't you? And, you know, which way will it fall? You know, do I feel, based on my experience with you, Natasha, based on our journey together or how I've seen or heard about you interacting with other people, do I feel safe enough to disagree with you, share a different idea, give you a different perspective? Or are you going to punish me? So in that moment, I'm doing that risk assessment, aren't I? In which way will I land? Now, we want people to land on the I will speak up, but that's hugely difficult for a lot of people. So the role was very much about supporting and enabling that, as well as looking at whatever structures, systems, policies, procedures work against that culture.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I can remember when you were working there and when you told me about that role, you would talk about, I don't know if he was the CEO, but the most senior leader at St John Ambulance at the time, and you would describe him as a very inclusive, enabling leader who allowed speaking up as part of the culture. I mean, how important do you think it is for that most senior leader to be the enabler of it?
Yeah, he was a massive advocate, and you know, he was like, absolutely, we need to do this. It's absolutely the right thing. And that was the point, it's the right thing. You know, that motivation of having that sense of, you know, moral compass, this is the right thing. Because where compassion comes in is, you know, we recognize with compassion that when we're leading with compassion, we want to alleviate and prevent suffering. And we recognize that people can suffer at work to varying degrees about varying different things. And if you are unable to speak up, share your ideas, perspectives, disagree, that is likely to lead you to suffer in some way. So where the leader, so where that CEO was coming from was, you know, of course I don't want people to suffer in the workplace. So that being so important as a starting point, recognizing, and I use that word deliberately, which can be provocative, that people can suffer at work, can't they?
You know,
the workplace can, you know, can be the cause of it. The environment and conditions that people need to work in can contribute to it. Or I often think it can be the place where we bring our suffering to. You know, it may not be as a result of my workplace, which is why I think leaders are almost like the first line responders to that. So if the person leading the organization doesn't get that to an extent, doesn't seem to care about that, or that's just a very alien concept, it can be a real struggle. Whereas when a leader gets it, understands it, and that's part of their value-driven purpose, all exciting things can happen, Natasha.
Well, indeed. And what do you think stops a leader from wanting to hear the truth?
Well, I think innately, you know, we're human beings, aren't we, before we're leaders. We don't suddenly, you know, morph into something else. We are still our frail, imperfect, to whatever extent, ego-driven human beings, aren't we? I think a range of things can play out. One, we can be mortified that maybe we've been the cause of some distress, pain or suffering. And we can respond to that in different ways. And I've seen that responded to in a relatively peaceful way, which would be, I'm so sorry, I hear you, let me listen, what can I do to put this right? It's very much down that approach. And that person is still struggling, but that's their default. And we have the other approach, which is defensive and guarded and protective and accusational, which I think a lot is driven by fear. You know, and I think I've been both those people.
Absolutely,
in my past, depending on maybe what the issue is, my relationship with the person or not that's presenting it to me, the level of risk I now feel because of what's being shared with me, maybe what else is going on in my life. How am I showing up in this position? Is this, you know, am I burning out? Am I stressed? Have I got issues? All of these things play out. So I think we show up as human beings to a large degree. So I think it requires a lot of self-awareness, a lot of consciousness, and choice about how am I going to choose to show up in this moment. Natasha has had the courage to come and talk to me about something which is difficult for her and difficult for me. But if I have no empathy, if I'm not seeing it in that way, I may show up in a way that hinders and not helps this situation. But I think it can be scary, and you know, it can feel like a risk, and I can bring fear to the situation, can't I?
Do you ever see double signals where the leader or leaders are saying, we want to hear the truth, we want you to speak up, please, you know, tell us when there is a problem or a challenge that you're facing or an observation you're making about us or the organisation that you think could be improved? And then when the person does speak up, they're actually met with resistance.
Yeah, it's certainly an element of careful what you wish for, isn't it? When I'm talking to organisations about culture, and my goodness, what a big topic that can be, I try and make it very practical and non-jargony. And one of the key things I say to them is, what type of a culture do you want? Because I've read all through all of your literature and your recruitment, and it says to me, if I join your organisation, I'm going to be empowered, have a great deal of autonomy, I'm going to be supported, respected, encouraged to speak up. You know, that sounds fantastic, sign me up. But I've joined the organisation for 3 months and that's not been my lived experience. Yeah. Now, it's probably not because anybody in the organisation is essentially bad, but there needs to be a correlation between what you say you are, what you say you want, and what is the reality. So I think there's an element of that, but there is an element of careful what you wish for. Because I think the reality is, once we start role modelling that behaviour, once we start encouraging people to speak up and they take that risk, my goodness, that's such a crucial moment, isn't it? That's such an opportunity for the culture to be a wonderful touch point where the culture can come alive. or it can be a great opportunity for the culture to be given a huge disservice. So I think we have to, you know, support our leaders to be very aware that if we're moving to this compassionate speaking up culture, actually we need to get into the detail of what that looks like and how we're going to support our leaders to actually be able to lead in that way, you know, because we can't bring old ways of leadership to that way. And often leaders aren't well supported and they need to be.
Well, okay, well, let's talk a bit more about that. What does leadership support look like?
Well, if you come and talk to me and you raise an issue about my practice or the results of a decision I've made or how I've made you feel, there's about how I respond in the moment, isn't there? Of course there is. So I might be intuitively in a place where I'm going to respond in a way that is desirable, that creates this safe environment where the person feels heard and listened to. Fantastic. However, even if that is the case, when I leave that interaction, where's my support? Because it's inevitably going to be an emotional experience to some degree. But I come out of that, and often I think there's the expectation that, oh, that's been done, move on to the next thing, or to the next team's meeting, and a very pragmatic, transactional approach. Whereas actually, from a human being's perspective, I might still have feelings, I might still be worried about the risk. So where's my coaching, mentoring, support? Who's got my back? I think there's an element of that, even when it's dealt with well. When it's dealt with poorly, the same thing again. How are we, not training leaders, but how are we supporting leaders to recognise that when we make a move towards these radical respect, candid, speaking up environments, that's going to require us to lean into a much more relationship-based way of leadership and a lot less of the hierarchical command and control, I tell, you do. That's not going to work, you know, because this person is, I'm now in relationship with this person, and that's where my focus needs to be.
Yeah. It's really interesting that you should say that, because I've been doing some work lately with one of the organisations that I work with, and I've been talking to them about the idea of moving away from giving real-time feedback, so, you know, in-the-moment feedback, to giving real-time reflections. Mm-hmm. And the reason, it's a very, very subtle sort of nuance in the language, but I think that feedback can often be seen as loaded and a judgment, whereas reflections, you know, I just want to share some reflections with you, is much less inflammatory and is more likely to lead to a sort of two-way discussion. So we're moving now from talking about feedback to talking about reflections. But of course, you and I have done leadership development with, you know, groups of leaders that we've worked with around radical candor. And you just talked about direct and caring. So that any feedback or discussions that are sort of a bit more difficult, maybe a bit more edgy, a bit more gritty, should be delivered directly, but with care. And Kim Scott is the founder of Radical Candor. So we both sort of buy into that concept, I think, don't we?
Yeah.
But how does that show up when people are speaking to each other directly with care? What's the impact of that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot in there that you said. I suppose my starting point for this, when I'm talking to people about, though I don't tend to use the term difficult conversations or anything, for me it's the conversations that count. You know, the value of leadership for me is largely defined by the willingness and ability of the leader to regularly engage in those conversations that count. Because if a leader is not doing that, then where's their value? Where's their impact? What are they doing? Because if the leader's not having those conversations, then who is? And the answer to that is usually no one. Where I think the model of radical candor, radical respect is useful, it helps, I suppose, like all helpful frameworks, it focuses on, in this case, a particular quadrant, doesn't it? How can we challenge people directly and show that we care personally without it feeling tokenistic and trite? So for me, that's a great description of compassionate leadership. Because, Natasha, if I care about you as a human being, if I see you as a human being, now that the reality is, Natasha, I may not like you. I might find you difficult to work with. If I was honest, I'd really like you to leave the team and resign. But the reality is, you're in my team. But as soon as I stop seeing you as a human being, and I see you as a blocker, a hindrance, a problem, you know, my delivery of my challenge might be brutal. Mm. It might be overtly direct. It may show very little care for you. Because actually, on one level, you're not really my cup of tea, Natasha. So it matters less whether you feel cared for or not. And I think that's a challenge and an opportunity. But I think whatever our relationship is, we need to see that person essentially as a human being of value. You know, once I lose sight of you being a real life human being, Natasha, with real life value, then I think I'm in trouble. Because even if the conversation's difficult, I see you. You're a human being. I see you. And because I'm compassionate, I'm compelled to have that difficult conversation, aren't I? Because it's not caring to not have the tough conversation with you. It's not caring to hope that poor behaviour you demonstrated or your poor performance is just going to get better. So often when I'm talking to leaders and teams, it says, if I'm leading with compassion, it absolutely compels me to have that conversation when it's needed. Because that shows how that I care.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you get looks around the room and go, well, of course it's caring. How is it caring to avoid the conversation, to hope it will get better, to water down the impact? But in order to do that, I need to challenge you directly. I need to be really clear. You know, as Brené Brown quotes, you know, clear is kind. So when we talk about operational compassion, my goodness, just be clear. It's one of the great gifts we can give. You know, clear is kind. Yeah. So if I can be clear about that, direct with the challenge, but not delivered it in a way that's brutal, intimidating, that leaves you feeling fearful, alone, diminished, then we can probably start having a useful conversation, as challenging as that might still be.
Yeah, well, actually, so we both know Matt Phelan of the Happiness Index, and he said the number one contributor to engagement, I think he said, because they measure engagement and happiness, is clarity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just speaks to that point. And, you know, purpose and being very, very purposeful in your endeavours and focusing on the things that matter most and providing clarity to the team as part of the conscious leadership model. But actually, clarity is one of the single most important things that leaders end up having to do, isn't it? And actually, it's not just about the role that you have and the objectives that you need to achieve. It is also about what you're doing, the contribution you're making to the team, and also the things I need you to do more of, or I need to see more of or build on, so that it's even better. And I often think that we lose sight of that as leaders. We're so busy getting the job done, getting the work done, that we're not really connecting with the individual and trying to help them to be at their absolute best.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think on the whole, I think people at work generally want to do a really good job. They're doing the very best they can for the very best of reasons with what they've got. You know, I think people in whatever role generally want to do the best they can. I think where managers and leaders can bring real extra value is trying to eliminate as many blockers, interferences and interruptions to that person's day.
Yeah,
the things that absolutely get in the way. Because after all, isn't a leader's role to create the conditions for other people to be really successful, to thrive and to flourish?
Mm.
Now, I don't see that as some sort of, you know, social media throwaway statement. I really believe that. I really, really believe that. So that requires leaders to be really intentional, to pay attention to what they're paying attention to. And I love that phrase, pay attention to what you're paying attention to. I ask myself that a lot because that drives my behaviours, it drives my decisions, it drives who and what I'm putting in my line of vision, if you like. But I think we're there to try and create the conditions for people to do really great work. But so often, as managers and leaders, we're doing so much of the work ourselves. And it's such an easy thing to say and such a hard thing to change. But I think we need to choose it. My point here is, and I say in my programmes, and compassion is a choice. It's not just going to fall out of something. We have to choose it. And once we've chosen it, we have to do stuff to make it actually real and practical, measurable and observable. But we have to choose it. We have to choose it every day. We have to choose it in my interactions. I have to choose it. So I have to be intentional, I have to be purposeful. But it's a choice. It doesn't just happen.
And when managers or leaders are being more compassionate, what are they doing?
Well, I suppose the fundamental here is leaders are in relationships with their people. And when leaders focus on their relationships, really powerful things can happen. So when people feel listened to, heard, seen, included, safe, trusted, supported, when they feel able to fully participate in work, as well as being part of the collective, when the environment they work in seeks to understand, like, rather than to blame, and when leaders work hard to create the conditions for those things to happen, really powerful things can happen. And that doesn't happen. Those things don't happen in environments where leaders don't show empathy, you know, when they don't care, when they exclude, discriminate, instill fear, disempower, control, restrict autonomy, ignore and dismiss other people's perspectives. You know, these are not the conditions that we thrive in. Mm. Sorry if anybody out there believes that we do, but we don't. You know, we don't thrive in those conditions. I suppose the uncomfortable truth is you might get a short-term performance spike if you instill fear and anxiety and intimidation in your troops. And someone has said to me, well, I can show you, Steve, on the performance graph that once I get really horrible, things really improve. And I say, well, I'm not surprised that over that week that happens. But let's look at all of the other measurables as well. So I think if we're looking for, you know, long-term, sustained, healthy and functional environments, we need to move past any sort of short-term focus, really. So I think what we're doing, well, I think for me, the really nice description around compassion is it's empathy plus thoughtful and meaningful action.
Mm.
So we talk about the power of empathy being hugely important and hugely respected from employees when they see it in their leaders. But compassion takes it a step further. It recognises that empathy is hugely powerful, but sometimes in isolation it's not enough. And sometimes a leader needs to take more intentional and purposeful action. So I love that. That little sum, empathy plus meaningful and thoughtful action. So your answer to your question, it can be very nuanced, can't it? But I need to think as a leader, what is the thoughtful and meaningful action in response to this situation? That's where I put my attention and my focus. Not to disempower the individual, not to make it all better for them and give them a big hug, although a well-timed hug can be helpful, but to really think with a bit of wisdom and a bit of discernment, have I got agency as a manager, as a leader in this situation to improve the situation? And if I have, then I should, whatever that might be.
And then what about for the leaders themselves? I mean, you talked earlier on about leaders needing support, but they probably also at times need self-compassion, as we all do. What's your take on the need for self-compassion to enable us to thrive?
So, thank you for that question and segue. I love the way you did that, Natasha. So, when I wrote my book and when I developed my framework to support compassionate leadership, at the absolute core of it is self-compassion. We cannot lead our lives and work with enhanced compassion. We cannot lead others with enhanced compassion unless we are showing ourselves the same level of high regard. How on earth can we? Because if we choose to lead our lives and work with compassion, we are choosing a tough route. We are choosing a tough route. And we don't want to be in a position where we're kind of burning bright and burning out quickly. So if we want our leadership to be sustainable over the long term, we have to think about how we care for ourselves. So I think with self-compassion, and I suppose that it's most simplistic as a definition, it's about treating ourselves with the same compassion and kindness that we would show to others. It's compassion turned inwards. So I think wherever we are in our leadership and our management role, practicing self-compassion, whatever that looks like, is vital, because otherwise we run the risk of the boom and bust, don't we? That where we spend all of our time is on the edge of burnout, looking over at the precipice of burnout, because it's quite addictive being on the end of burnout, isn't it? It can be quite exciting. It can be a lot
speak
of
for yourself.
Well, my caveat is I'm certainly not advocating it, but I think it can almost become a bit of an addiction, can't it? You know, we're on the edge of burnout, then we pull ourselves back a bit, then we hang out there again. And actually, I'm saying we don't need to choose that. We can choose to be way back from there at the picnic table, looking at the edge, but it's a long way away. So I think there's something about how we sustain that. So self-compassion is absolutely vital. And I think Dr. Kristin Neff introduced me to a wonderful phrase, which is fierce compassion, which I love, because compassion can be really fierce. And she talks about fierce self-compassion, and there being two aspects to this. And one of them being tender self-compassion. And this is where, as human beings, we learn to accept ourselves. Easy thing to say, but we understand that we're flawed and imperfect, generally doing the best we can with what we've got. And sometimes we speak to ourselves so harshly, we can be so tough on ourselves, so judgmental, so blaming, so critical, our inner critic can be really loud. And I often say to people, would you ever speak to your best friend the way you speak to yourself sometimes? Mm. And the answer is always, well, of course not. I would never speak to somebody else the way I speak to myself. So tender self-compassion would say, where can we just speak a little bit more kindly to ourselves, be a bit more gentle on ourselves, choose to be less harsh, less critical? And then this idea of fierce self-compassion, when we need to take action, this is more practical, when we need to put ourselves first, which can be very difficult for us to do because we're brought up, you know, put other people before you. So I challenge that narrative with, how on earth can we do that if we're constantly on no battery? We have to know when to put ourselves first. We have to know when we need to be self-serving in order for us to lead and live in a way that is outward looking and compassionate. So this idea of fierce compassion, when do we need to show ourselves some tenderness? And when do we need to take fierce action to put ourselves first practically, which I think is really important because leadership should be for the long term. And this idea that all we're going to do is serve others to our detriment, I just don't sign up for it. Just don't sign up for it at all.
Well, so, I mean, I see you modelling that in the way that you work because you seem to be pretty good at setting clear boundaries. When you're on holiday, you're on holiday and you're sort of unapologetic about that. You know, as you mentioned, one of your children needs support with the medical condition that they suffer from. You make time for that. How have you been able to do that without the fear that, you know, the wheel's going to fall off the bus? Because I think for a lot of people, they don't take that fierce action because they think, I'm going to lose my job or I'm going to lose my business or I won't earn enough money. How do you do it anyway?
Yeah, and it's important that you're aware that I do feel and think those things as well.
Right, okay.
Less so now since I had a proper job and now I do this as a proper job, which has been 5 years now.
Right.
So I think in answer to that question, I fought against it because I realised with things that had changed in our lives that actually I couldn't come into my office for 8 hours, 5 days a week, which I'd be quite happy doing, by the way. But one, I realised I can't because of other things that need my time. And initially I fought against that. Secondly, I was also transitioning from being an employee, which was, well, I need to be in work 8 hours a day because I've gone self-employed. And if I'm not at work 8 hours a day, I'll be terribly guilty and my family will think I'm a terrible person and I'm lounging about watching Netflix. So I had to unplug from being an employee to being a freelancer. So there was a whole period around that as well. But, and whilst I wouldn't obviously want my child, I wouldn't ever want that for them or for us, what that has done, like the kind of weird opportunities it brings, which I would definitely swap, by the way, but the reality is the reality that I sometimes have to work for 2.5-3 hours a day. So I suppose in answer to your question, what I've realised is in order for me to live peacefully, and that's what that means to me, to live in a way that I'm relatively emotionally stable, healthy and functional, and I can regulate my emotional self effectively and do the things that I love, I've had to make some different choices. So I spend, some of the choices I made were, I spend a lot less time trying to be right. And by that, I mean, I focus more on being happy and content. And I found entertaining the possibility that sometimes I might just be wrong or not entirely right opens up my curiosity, reduces judgment and encouraging me to question and include others. So there's a kind of different approach there. I used to feel that, well, I'm the main provider, you know, I'm the director, I need to be right, be seen to be right. And I've kind of shed all of that skin now completely. I spend a lot less time trying to control and worry about the future. I know this is a bit cliche because I could spend a lot of time in the future and have in the past, and it didn't serve me, my relationships and my family well. So I now pay much more attention to how I'm living in this moment, because that's the only thing I can do anything about, isn't it? How I show up now in this moment with you, Natasha, is the only thing I've got control over, and not all the things that could or couldn't go wrong or might go wrong. So I had to choose, and that was a journey in itself, but I had to choose to think differently. I definitely pay attention to what I'm paying attention to, notice where my attention is, where I am distracted. I can go down all sorts of rabbit holes. So I've put in different boundaries. So for me, I've come off all social media. So for me, that was a personal choice, and I'm a lot healthier because of it. That's not a comment on social media. That's a comment on my relationship with social media.
Yeah.
Putting in some boundaries, being less nice and being more compassionate. And that's a whole different discussion there. So I spend, my focus is less on being nice and more on being compassionate, which is an area I explore in my book and often in my programs. What's the difference between being nice and being compassionate? So I try and role model that and be careful of my expectations about me, you know, manage my expectations about what I can do. But all of those things I've had to choose, and I drop the ball regularly, but I focus much more on trying to be content and happy, whatever that looks like. And I just have to say no to a lot more things than ideally I would like to, and then just be okay about that.
But what's interesting is that I think I'm right in saying the business is more successful than it's ever been.
Well, this is the, I'm about to say this is the crazy part, but of course it's not crazy. It's probably because I've been going for 5 years now. I'm really busy up until the end of the year and going into next year. But I think part of that is because I've true to myself, which is I do the thing that I care most about. I focus on the things I care most about. And I think over the last 5 years, I've got clearer about what that is in terms of work. I always knew what it was in terms of my values and my purpose. But now I'm clear about what, how that relates to work, where I bring value, where I do something useful and do something I care about. So that's become much easier. Whereas when I started the business, I scattergunned everything because I was like, please give me work, please give me work. And I still want work, please give it to me. But now it's much more focused on this is my niche, this is where I bring value. And as a consequence, I think I've just become a lot more focused. But you have to shed things, you have to say no to certain things and just be okay with it as well.
Well, I mean, you are the person that has said to me more than once, keep the most important thing the most important thing.
Yeah, yeah. Keep the main thing the main thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it's massively helpful. So if a new manager, in fact, in our local bubble tea shop, where we spend far too much time, given my youngest
daughter's, your family.
Daughter's addiction to bubble tea.
Yeah.
It's a habit that, you know, I need to feed. Gosh, I mean, that's not true at all. But we do love our local bubble tea shop. And there's a chap in there who set it up. He went to university, did his studies, set up a small bubble tea implant in his university. That went really well.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, I mean, it was super cool. So it made a success of that. And then he moved from London down to here, found this place, and he has set up this bubble tea shop. And I think he's still got the university shop too, and he's just honestly kid, like the nicest guy. We always have a little chat with him. He knows our order off by heart now, and he was just asking me the other day what I do for a living, and I said, oh, I've got a leadership development company. And he was like, oh, that's really interesting, because I'm now managing people, and you know, where can I find out more about what you do? And because what we do is often business to business, and you know, this chap hasn't got access to a big corporate budget. You know, he doesn't necessarily get access to our teachings. He can obviously read our books. But it just got me thinking about how we can get this out to more people. How do we extend the reach of what we do, which we know has a great impact on the managers and leaders that we work with in organisations? How do we get this out to them? So for Zenchai founder and all of the other sort of new managers out there who just really want to know how to do the right thing by their staff at the start of their new journey into leadership, what advice would you give him through a lens of compassionate leadership?
Just breathe. Those would be my two words, and I don't think you thought that's where I was going to go, Natasha.
I did not.
I can see the look on your face.
I did not.
You thought I was going to say something much more inspiring and corporate. But it's the same thing I say to myself, and I say to when I do work with new and aspiring managers, and when I do my leadership programs, we always start with self-compassion. And the first module is always leading self with compassion. And the first part of that module is learn how to breathe. And of course, everybody looks at me as if, you know, what on earth is he talking about? And for any of you that undertake breath work or have done any breath work work, you'll know how fundamental regulating your nervous system is. So if ever I'm asked to give advice, I will say, learn how to breathe. Because if you can breathe well, you will be able to regulate your nervous system, and that will move you from react to respond in the moment. And the more you can move from react to respond at any given moment, the more you can bring your attention and focus to what's happening immediately in front of you. So that's my non-conventional approach, but just breathe. And I think it's great advice for us in life, recognizing that we have control over our nervous system to a much greater degree than we think. And we either don't know or we've forgotten how to tap into that. And the greatest gift we can give ourselves is how to take a mindful pause, how to down-regulate our nervous system in order for us to show up in the way that we want to. And in my language, that would be show up with compassion.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you so much. And it's there and it's accessible instantly.
Instantly.
And you don't have to go and read a book about it. You just have to slow down.
You don't have to go on a retreat for a week with Natasha and Steve.
Although, wouldn't that be fun?
Well, that would be nice. You can just breathe in the moment. But there is a way of doing it and there are techniques, but it's very practical. It can be very accessible. And I vocalise it wherever I can. Don't underestimate the power of your breath and how you can down-regulate, because that will enable you to show up in a way that you would much rather do than maybe sometimes we do. So that would be my advice.
Fantastic. Breathe. Thank you. I'm sure that's going to change a lot of people's lives, just remembering that we can actually do that, that we are allowed to breathe. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast today, Steve. If people want to find out more about what you do, where can they find you?
Website, www.thecompassionateleadershipcompany. I'm on LinkedIn, Steve Hargreaves. My book is The Compassionate Leader's Playbook, available on Amazon or Waterstones. Or you can go on the website and just send me a message and let's chat about
Fantastic.
Stuff.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I knew it would be enjoyable, and of course it was. Thank you very much for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Pieces of Choice. For any information on what we've covered in today's episode and to connect with my guests, head to the show notes. It would be great if you could rate and review the podcast and subscribe now so you don't miss out on any future episodes.